From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, resumed classes today for the first time since the mass shooting there 2 weeks ago. 17 people were killed, including 14-year-old freshman Elena Petty. Her older brother Patrick, who's also a student at the school, survived. I spoke earlier with their father, Ryan Petty, who was outside the school today. Mr. Petty, welcome. Thank you for joining us, and we're so sorry about your daughter.
Thank you.
Do you think that it's appropriate for the school to reopen today?
I do. It actually was good to see the kids back. They got a chance on Sunday to come back and be on campus to pick up some of their belongings, and I thought that was a good first step. It was good to see the students back here today.
Your son, Patrick, who is 17, is he going back to school today?
Patrick is here today, yes.
And how did he feel about that?
Patrick's trying to be tough. He's obviously lost his sister, and he and his sister were very close. They were in the JROTC program together. So I think this has hit him especially hard. It's hit our whole family. Whole family hard, but I think he'll be missing her at school today. But he's trying to be tough. He's trying to be strong.
We hear there's a pretty heavy security presence there today. Do you think that's helpful to the students and to families?
Well, this is now the safest school in America. So, I'm telling everybody this time must be different. We need to get our schools secured. Nothing's going to happen to the students today at Stoneman Douglas, but the beginning of the healing process for them. But the schools around the country are not secured, and we need to get them secured.
What have the last 2 weeks been like for you?
Well, there's a big hole in our hearts and a big hole in our family. I think... You know, we go through a range of emotions every day. Just stunned that this happened. We miss Elena dearly. Never thought that this could happen to us. I think there are times where we still can't believe it's real.
You've also been kind of thrust into a national debate about what to do about these sorts of things. What do you think about that, the fact that you're in the middle of this, not by your own choosing, but just because of what happened?
Yeah, there's 1,000 things I'd rather be doing today.
Yeah.
I just don't want any other parents. I don't want any other students to have to go through what we're going through right now. So, if you knew Elena... You'd know she was such a sweet girl, and she'd come into a room and just light up the room, and she was everybody's friend, and she loved service. She loved to serve other people, and she loved to serve her community. And I'm calling what I'm doing right now is, another act of service in her name. And I just don't want any other parents, any other students to have to go through what we're going through right now.
And what do you think needs to be done to make sure that no other parents have to go through that?
Yeah. It's a really difficult question to answer because I think, I wish there was a single piece of legislation that we could pass and this would never happen again. Unfortunately, it's just not that simple. But I do think there are some things that we can rally around. And when I say this time must be different, what I mean is, after every other school shooting, we've been mired down in a debate over gun control and the Second Amendment, and both sides are incredibly polarized. We all know the arguments well on both sides. We don't even trust each other's motives at this point on that issue. So if we go down that path, in my view, then this will be just like every other school shooting. So my message is this time must be different. And the way we're going to make this different is we're going to come together on school security, take these soft targets. These schools are soft targets. We've got to change that. We've got to keep guns out of the hands of people that want to hurt themselves and hurt other people. And I think in this case, in particular, there were signs that the shooter wanted to hurt other people. And we'll figure out in time, through investigations, we'll figure out what went wrong here. But it was clear that law enforcement needed some additional capabilities to be able to address this and deal with this. So my message is we're going around in the state of Florida with Governor Scott. He's proposed legislation to keep guns out of the hands of people that want to hurt other people. He's proposing to secure the schools, and he's proposing more funding for mental health. And I think those things will make this different. And then there's some longer-term things we need to do. But right now, those are the things that we can rally around and get done.
What do you think about an assault weapons ban or universal background checks?
Well, look, we've got background checks already. And unfortunately, the shooter passed all the background checks. So, you know, there are a couple of things that we need to make sure are done. NICS database, we need to make sure all of the counties and all of the states are putting the correct information into that database. There's some things we can do from a data perspective to make that better. I wish it was as easy as banning a certain type of weapon, but unfortunately, if you're intent on hurting somebody, you know, you're going to move to option B or C, right? And I don't want to give anybody any ideas, but unfortunately, it's not as simple as banning a particular type of weapon, in my view.
That's Ryan Petty, whose daughter, Elena Petty, was killed in the shooting in Parkland, Florida. Mr. Petty, again, we're so sorry about that, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, to Afghanistan now, where after 16 years of war, President Ashraf Ghani is offering to hold peace talks with the Taliban with no preconditions. The BBC's Zia Shahriar is in Kabul. Zia, peace talks have been proposed before to no avail. Why is it different this time?
Robin, it's different in the sense that the Afghan president has offered probably the most ambitious and unprecedented peace plan to the Taliban. He's offering to recognize the Taliban as a political group. He's offering to give them political office in Kabul. He is saying that the Afghan government's ready to release all Taliban prisoners, give them complete amnesty, and even the government's ready to change the constitution if that was required as a peace condition. So it has a lot of incentives for the Taliban to look at it.
Well, the Taliban hasn't responded yet. The militants that have been spoken to say they're waiting to hear from their leadership. But what's the sense that the Taliban would want to be a political party when they want to be the government as they once were? I mean, remember, they were removed from power. They led the government, but were removed from power by U.S.-led troops in 2001. Remind us who the Taliban is and, you know, then pick that up. What's their incentive here?
Yeah, the Taliban is a radical Islamic group in Afghanistan and Pakistan. They took over Kabul in 1996. They ruled Afghanistan, 90% of Afghanistan, until 2001. And they were accused of a lot of massacres across the country, massacre of minority and other ethnical groups. So to have them as a political group, it's something difficult to conceive. But this is the offer that President Ashraf Ghani has given them. And I think there will be some reactions to it from other political groups in Afghanistan in the next few days.
Well, we're reminded, too, that there isn't just one Taliban. There are different factions within it. But back to this, you know, incentive question. One of the reasons that this offer may be coming now is that the Taliban has been relentless in their attacks. They would appear to be, you know, gaining ground. Given that they have seemed strong, what would their incentive be to accept this?
From Kabul's perspective, this is the right time because the U.S. is putting a lot of pressure on Pakistan. The Taliban are under increased military pressure by U.S. airstrikes as well as Afghan security forces' ground operations across the country. The U.S. has recommitted itself to Afghanistan. And on the other hand, as you just mentioned, yes, the Taliban have also increased their attacks in the last 2 months. They have launched very deadly attacks in Kabul and other main cities in Afghanistan. And also, according to a recent BBC report, they are at least active in the 70% of the territory of Afghanistan. So there is a sort of stalemate. And it was interesting that the Taliban offered to talk to Washington yesterday directly, saying that they are ready to talk to Washington. Mm. So there are signs of hope.
Well, meanwhile, just briefly, what's public opinion about this, Zia?
Afghans are certainly supporting a peace process, I would say. They are very tired of the long war going on in this country. But they've seen these sort of processes many times, which haven't led to peace. So I am sure they are very suspicious about it.
That's the BBC's Zia Shahriar in Kabul, Afghanistan. Zia, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Robin.
In Florida, state lawmakers have voted to advance a gun control bill that would allow trained teachers to carry concealed guns in schools, something the NRA supports. It would also raise the age to buy long guns from 18 to 21, something the NRA doesn't support, which is why Florida NRA lobbyist Marion Hammer testified against the bill.
We have long supported keeping guns out of the hands of those who have dangerous mental illness. We do not support gun control provisions of this bill. These provisions are nothing more than an attack on the Second Amendment rights of law-abiding people.
So who is Marion Hammer? Well, she's behind most of the pro-gun legislation in this country. She started as a volunteer and then was the NRA's president in the 1990s. Now she is the top lobbyist in Florida, where her emails to lawmakers and legions of supporters can make or break a bill. Mike Spies has seen many of those emails. He's a staff writer at The Trace, a nonprofit news organization covering guns in America, which co-produced his piece on Hammer for The New Yorker. Mike, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And you start your article with an anecdote from the Parkland school shooting. You were there 2 days after the shooting with Jared Moskowitz, a Democratic rep from Florida. A student approached Dan Daley, who's a city commissioner in Coral Springs, and the student said, "Do something." Pick up the conversation from there.
Dan had to explain to the student that he was by law restrained from doing anything because there's a law that exists in Florida that prevents cities from passing gun restrictions or regulations stricter than those imposed at the state level. And if they do, they could be removed from office and also fined thousands of dollars.
And Moskowitz, again, the state rep, turned to you and said what?
That's the legacy of Marion Hammer.
Okay, let's talk about Marion Hammer. There are so many other laws that she's behind in Florida, not just backing them, but you write, writing them in many cases?
As one of her former colleagues points out, she single-handedly creates legislation. She's not only originating the legislation, but she's also, before it has a sponsor, working directly with government staffers, bureaucrats, on the language before it even gets to a lawmaker.
Well, and this isn't just you surmising this. You got thousands of emails. You also quote Steve Crisafulli, the Republican House Speaker between 2014 and 16, who said, "Members will go to Marion Hammer. They'll say, I want to carry a bill for the NRA this year. What are you working on? What are your priorities?"
Yeah, that's right. And he was, you know, one of two major Republican lawmakers who said something to that effect, the other one being Dennis Baxley, who's now a state senator, who also said the way the process works is Marion works on it with a government staffer. And then when it's in the shape that it needs to be in, he comes in and puts his name on it. And he also says that he's not very detail-oriented, so he's not even really looking through the bill. She'll tell you that she's just giving input, but the emails show, and also her allies will say, that they can't often do anything without getting her permission. And she's the one, as the emails also show, dictating language specifically. There's just a paper trail of that.
Isn't this what lobbyists do?
The difference with her is that most lobbyists are contractors who lobby on behalf of a variety of issues. she's been on one issue for the last four decades, and almost always she is the only outside voice in the room. Legislation that could be termed gun control legislation, that goes nowhere in the Florida legislature, often because she can just send us, you know, a brief email to a policy chief on a committee saying we don't want the bill to be heard, and then it doesn't get heard. I've had other lobbyists review the emails, and they often say, bar none, she's got the best access. She gets replies immediately from the governor's office, important state lawmakers, staffers. I mean, they know that she's an authority.
Well, for instance, let's take the bill in 2011, the Firearm Owners Privacy Act. Colloquially, it's called Docs v. Glocks. It prohibited doctors from asking patients if they own guns. It's something doctors like to ask to point out potential health hazards for children if there's a gun in the house or hazards to the suicidal. A lawmaker made a slight change to the bill. She excoriated him. Again, this is in an email exchange. He wrote back, I had no intent to change the thrust of anything. See attached and let me know if that will work. I mean, as you said, there's a paper trail of this.
Right. And that wasn't even a lawmaker who was getting excoriated. That was the policy chief whose job is just to make sure that language is constitutional. But the policy chief is just bypassing the lawmaker in that email and going right to the lobbyist because the policy chief knows that the lobbyist, in this case Marion Hammer, is the final and absolute authority on the legislation. And you could see how this process is so corrupted because that law, in the end, last year, wound up getting ruled unconstitutional by a federal court. And if the policy chief had been able to do the job the way she's supposed to be able to do it instead of getting cowed by Marion Hammer and having to follow her directions, it's possible that that whole thing could have been avoided. Instead, it cost taxpayers over $1 million to defend it in court.
Look, she started as a local NRA volunteer in Florida in the 1970s. This was back when the NRA was really just a sporting organization, but it was starting to establish its lobbying arm, which transformed it into a gun rights organization, and then worked her way up and really became a star, a superstar, with pioneering the concealed carry law. This was in the 1980s. And the concealed carry law passed in Florida, and then, of course, we know it's across the United States, was part of the thinking that she was a part of. It's too hard to change the federal gun laws, change them on the state level, maybe change them in Florida, and then spread them across the states.
That was the NRA's strategy and has been its strategy for a long time, and it's been a very successful strategy. There's a lot less attention paid to state legislatures. It's a lot easier just to move legislation and to influence lawmakers. And because she's been so successful, Florida has become sort of the test kitchen because she's able to move bills in a way that others aren't.
She was behind the Stand Your Ground law introduced in 2004, reminding people before that law, Americans were forbidden to use force if they had the option of fleeing. The new law removed that duty to retreat. She led the charge behind it. It passed. Then years later, 2012, George Zimmerman shoots and kills Trayvon Martin, and there were calls to review the law. She actually fought to enhance Florida's Stand Your Ground laws.
So now Stand Your Ground's got a really interesting thing built into it, which is that you get a path to immunity from trial if you invoke Stand Your Ground in what's called a pretrial hearing. And previously, the deal was if you wanted an immunity trial, the burden was on the defense to prove its case. This law shifted the burden to prosecutors in the pretrial hearing, essentially meaning prosecutors are now required to try a case two times.
So in 2017, Marion Hammer was behind this move to make prosecutors prove someone didn't have to use a gun as opposed to defendants proving that they did. But at that time, there was a Republican lawmaker who had some reservations. You seem to be saying that the emails you've recovered show that she effectively killed a judgeship for him.
She punished him. That's one of her tools. I mean, it's part of the reason she's so effective is she's able to use the government to hold her flock accountable if they wind up breaking with her.
Look, these laws are incubated in Florida. They're spread across the country. And actually, you quote David Cole of the ACLU, who writes admiringly of Hammer because of her ability to get results. He says, for 100 years, the Second Amendment was analyzed in terms of protecting state militias. The shift toward it having to do with individual rights can be traced to Marion Hammer. You point to one thing that she said early on in her career that helped in this shift from thinking of the Second Amendment about militias and thinking of it as about individual defense. It was her own story of being tracked by men.
So yeah, in the 80s, as she was pushing her concealed carry law, she began to tell this story, which was that one night after she was leaving her office, she walked into a parking garage. And she was approached by a carload of menacing men who were saying all kinds of sexually suggestive things to her. And she talks about how she felt threatened and that they were going to do something bad to her. So she pulled out the handgun that she had in her purse, very cinematically raised it into the headlights so they could see it, and then they sped out of the garage. She was saved by her weapon. She never called the police, so there's no police report to corroborate it. But nonetheless, it's permanently tied to that concealed carry legislation as an argument for it. And the timing of it was definitely fortuitous.
So, Mike Spies, we started talking about the law that Marion Hammer backed that would fine or remove from office officials in towns or cities that pass stricter gun restrictions than the state of Florida has. But now we're hearing from Coral Gables and Broward County as well that they are considering taking those fines and making tougher restrictions. Governor Scott, the Republican who is said to be considering a run for the Senate, is also considering tougher restrictions than the NRA wants. Do you think that Marion Hammer's stranglehold has loosened? Or do you think those efforts will fail because they will run into the buzzsaw that she apparently is legislatively? What do you think is going to happen here?
Well, I think at the local level, it's maybe a brilliant political maneuver to challenge the governor and the state to remove those city officials from office in the wake of this shooting would be just an unbelievably politically tone-deaf thing to do. At the state level, we're just in uncharted territory right now. As it stands now, it seems like there's enough Republicans that are willing to back what Scott is suggesting. And there is one thing in that bill that Democrats don't like, which involves arming certain teachers. So that could become a negotiating tactic. No matter what, Scott, I think, is pretty insulated. If enough Republicans get behind a bill that it gets to his desk, then he ultimately can say he's reflecting the will of the legislature. And if he does run for Senate, as most people think he will, this is, again, new territory. He's going to be put in the position of choosing between Marion and her resources and the Parkland students. And it's a position that I don't think anyone's ever been in before.
Mike Spies, staff writer at The Trace, a nonprofit news organization covering guns in America. His story, The NRA Lobbyist Behind Florida's Pro-Gun Policies, was produced in partnership with The New Yorker. Mike, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me. It was really great, Rob.
A report out today by the Governor's Highway Safety Association finds that nearly 6,000 pedestrians were killed on American streets last year, in part because of people who are walking while texting. Richard Redding is director of safety for Sam Schwartz Consulting, the firm hired to write the report. He joins us on Skype. Richard, how does that number compare to previous years?
You have to go back over 25 years to find a time in American history where that many people die in pedestrian crashes. The last 2 years have set records for modern times.
And how much of the blame does go to people who are walking around while distracted or driving while distracted, probably by a phone?
Well, unfortunately, smartphones are like a visual magnet, and people can't seem to keep their eyes off them. I don't want to single out any one particular road user in this case. Drivers bear a lot of responsibility. You know, keeping in mind that even at speeds as low as 30 miles an hour, you know, a driver looking down for a couple of seconds is essentially blindfolded and traveling more than 50 feet. Pedestrians, if they're distracted, add to that safety concern. You know, imagine a scenario where both a driver is looking down and a pedestrian staring right at a phone. They don't see each other coming. And again, we don't want to jump to conclusions and say that's driving all pedestrian crashes, because it's not. But we've seen a surge in pedestrian fatalities since 2010, and that coincides with rapid increase in cell phone use, particularly smartphone use, and multimedia messaging on those phones.
You also point out that a lot of the fatalities happen at night, which indicates that maybe light has something to do with this.
Absolutely. This has been a longstanding concern. We see in the most recent data, 75% of pedestrian fatalities occur in the dark. You know, but likewise, again, there, The glow of a cell phone on the dashboard of a car can be very distracting and cause drivers to not see what's happening right in front of their face.
Is location a factor when you look at different cities and states? Do you see differences in the number of fatalities?
Yeah, there are variances across the states and across cities. So for sure, you know, while, for example, on a national basis, 18% of pedestrian fatalities occur at intersections, the vast majority of pedestrian fatalities occur away from intersections, mid-block, you know, places where traffic speeds are higher. But there are states, New York is one of them, where a larger proportion of pedestrian fatalities occur at intersections.
Hmm. You also make a connection to legalized marijuana and that that may have had some impact on pedestrian fatalities. Explain that.
Yeah, well, this is the first opportunity that we've had to look at some early data. While there's no definitive link here in the study, and we're not claiming a hard connection, it's curious that in the 8 states that legalized recreational marijuana, there was over 16% increase in pedestrian fatalities, whereas all other states combined, there was a drop. So it could be an early warning sign that marijuana is having its desired effect in terms of people being less in the moment. You know, let's face it, people get high for a reason. It alters the state of mind.
That's Richard Redding, who is Director of Safety at Sam Schwartz Consulting. We'll link you to the report at hearandnow.org. Richard, thank you.
Thank you so much.
It is time now for a special Laotian edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. And joining us today is Vanasan Kedara, who is host of Lao Diaspora on Voice of America, based in Washington. She's originally from Luang Prabang, Laos. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hello, welcome. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for being here. And I'm apologetic to you if I didn't say your name properly. It sounds so much better when you say it. So can you just say your name for us?
Yes, I would say Vanasan Kedara or Vanasan Kedara in English.
Okay, wonderful.
Close enough.
Well, thank you so much. And by the way, I was just in Luang Prabang, which is an absolutely beautiful city. I don't want to tell too many people to go there because right now it feels sort of untouched by tourism.
Yes,
but
yes.
But tell us a little bit about it, first of all, before we get to the music.
Actually, I left Luang Prabang when I was 7. And when I went back 1999 as part of my graduate program. So I remember exactly. So it hasn't changed, but thanks for the UNESCO to keep Luang Prabang the way it is.
Because they've named it a World Heritage Site. Right?
Yes, yes, yes. I think Luang Prabang is one of the special places because not only the UNESCO site, but this is combining the place and the culture and the people together. So that's not easy.
And how would you describe the music of Laos to people who have not heard it?
I would have to say it's associated with the instrument that's really made in Laos, like the bamboo flute. And that's comprised with so many folklore. I would say each region have their own song. So then people can tell you that's from the north, the south, from southern you know, the middle.
You can tell
where the song
is from based on what it sounds like.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, well, let's listen to what you have brought us. And I'm going to have you say the names of these because you'll do a much better job than I will. Tell us what the first song is.
The first song is called Jampa Mueang Lao. Wait.
Now, this song was originally composed in the 1930s.
Yes.
Why did you want to start with this one?
Because this song is written in like a mid-30s. During that era, the Laos want to be independent from France. And those people who the group, like revolutionary people, kind of like living in exile and trying to go back, it just remind me them how they miss home. Everyone would know that's a Lao song. And that's coming, like every person can sing. And they have so many versions of that. And the one I bring it to you, it's kind of modernize it. And it's still beautiful.
And who is Tita Vieng Chan?
Tita Vieng Chan is a new singer from Laos, and I picked that because it's kind of offbeat and very different than the older version. So that's why I kind of mix with the modernized rhythm with the traditional song.
Okay,
the
let's
Lao
listen
song.
To the next one. Tell us what this one is.
Yes, the next song is by Udon Vong Si. It's Sivit Khon.
Now, this song is political. What's it about?
Yes, I spoke to the composer. He's a very legendary Lao composer, and he talked about this during that time when he wrote the song. It's about the transition of the new political era, and they want to teach the people about life, just like a river. When it, you know, flow down, it never come back. So it's up to you whether you be the honest, corrupted, kind of, you know, you have to really stay righteous to become a person. Once your life is gone, all you do, you cannot take anything with you. What you have is make a good dignity and pride and make a, you know, proud of the country that you serve.
Okay, up next we have?
We have Sien Can Be My. This song is very the heart of the Lao music. It's called Lam Vong. It's Soca Dance. Any event, any function, we would have this kind of song play in the background, and then people would circle and dance together. It's for happiness. And the composer, it's during the fall of the communists, and then he resides in France. So then he start writing a lot of song, and many, many singers sing his song. And this one is bring about the New Year's, about the Lao can, the instrument of Laos is kind of combined and having fun.
Has a Lao song ever made it big in the United States?
We have a very small market as far for the United States, but still, you know, we still want to preserve, because song is really our culture, it's really our language, and we're trying to teach the younger generation, so by listening to songs and, you know, but it's never make it so big.
Okay, well, we have time for one more song. What's the last one?
The last one that I picked, because he's a young Laotian American, grew up here, and he's really mixed the balance of the rock and roll and the Lao instrument, and the name of the song is Hao Bin Kun Lao, it means we are loud, so by Saki Meg Marakot. Africa, China, Canada, Georgia, you Russia, Georgia, you England, you New Zealand, Philippines, India, Georgia, you Cambodia, Vietnam, Australia, Georgia, you Japan, for long you're the money, Finland, Malaysia, you America, how been called?
So this one is very different than the others that you've brought us. Does anything tie all this Lao music together?
Yes, because each one has a meaning. You know, the song, I think each composer, when they write something, it's associated with the cultures, with everything. So it's a symbolic of that period. Mm. So it's kind of like the period we are here as a refugee. And, you know, it's kind of that transition period of how the music migrated.
Do you think Lao music is most closely related to Thai music?
Not quite, because, you know, when you listen to music, it's you can understand some Lao word and the Thai word. But for the Lao person, when we write, we're very careful. We try not to mix the Thai, definitely. Yeah, but the last song, you can see that he's totally Americanized. So he can, you know, Australia, Japan, and Cambodia. What he's trying to get out of that song is really trying to tell the people that even though we grew up in different part of the world, that we are still Lao person. That's what that song means.
That's Vanessan Kadara, who is a host of Lao Diaspora on Voice of America, based in Washington. Vanessan, Kap Chai Lala, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
The body of evangelist Billy Graham will lie in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol building today and tomorrow, only the fourth private citizen to lie in honor. Graham died last week at 99, and he's being remembered around the world as the organization he started in 1950 begins a new era without him. The Billy Graham Evangelistic Association is now led by his son Franklin, who will deliver his father's eulogy on Friday. The younger Graham also spreads what he sees as the word of salvation, but he's no stranger to controversy. Jeff DeBeery from member station WUNC has this profile.
Franklin Graham gazes out of a large window in a corner room at the Billy Graham Library Complex in Charlotte, North Carolina. The conversation jumps around, first from squirrels and his love for the outdoors, then to professors, many of whom he says belittle Christianity, and on to his friend, Sarah Palin. Franklin bears a strong resemblance to his late father, and while the presence and delivery might not quite be the same, the Graham family message echoing in the office sounds familiar.
I'm here to tell you that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. Not Muhammad, not Buddha. Don't believe in those guys. It's Jesus Christ. And so, yes, I want to promote the Christian faith. Why? Because it is the faith. It is the way. It is the truth.
Franklin Graham is a preacher's son. He was kicked out of high school and college. For a long time, following in his father's footsteps seemed unlikely. On his 22nd birthday, he was with his dad in Switzerland during a conference. After dinner at an Italian restaurant on Lake Geneva, they took a stroll.
So we walked a little ways and we stopped. He said, Franklin, I want you to know that your mother and I, we love you. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, we walk a little further. And then he stops and he looks me in the eye and he said, Franklin, he said, I sense that there is a battle for the soul of your life. And you're going to have to make a choice, either to accept Christ and his claims or reject him. It's your choice. You're going to have to make a choice. And when he said that, it kind of made me angry because I knew what he was saying was right.
Graham says he accepted Jesus 2 weeks later. Since that moment, more than four decades ago, he has preached the word of Christ to millions of people and has become the public face of the Graham family. But some have questioned whether his approach is far more controversial, conservative, and combative than his father's. UNC Asheville religious studies professor Roger Payne.
Franklin is someone who speaks not sort of with the broader umbrella that Billy Graham had used, but someone who really wants to identify with one particular political and religious philosophical ideology.
Graham has aligned himself with the neoconservative political right. He called Islam an evil, wicked religion following the 9/11 attacks, and has publicly questioned the faith of former President Obama, later apologizing. Scholars like Professor Payne say we will probably never know for certain whether what has been perceived as a shift in philosophy by the organization was driven by Billy or Franklin.
Probably, to some extent, this reflects Billy Graham's own political leanings. But again, he's just never been quite as overt about that until recent years. So the question is whether the association is sort of moving in that direction and kind of dragging him along with it.
At his father's 95th birthday party, Palin, Rupert Murdoch, Roger Ailes, and Donald Trump were all in attendance. In 2012, Franklin was an outspoken supporter of Amendment 1, which banned same-sex marriage in North Carolina. Dan Pierce is a history professor at UNC Asheville.
He has decided, for whatever reasons, that is really kind of casting himself more in the Jerry Falwell mold, who feels an obligation to speak out on these political issues and encourage, and not only speak out, but encourage people to vote this way.
Franklin concedes some aspects of the organization have shifted, but maintains the mission is still to spread the word of forgiveness from God.
Oh, sure, it's different. And some of it is my leadership, and a lot of it has to do with the times in which we're living. But the message is exactly the same. We have not changed our message, and we haven't changed our focus as an organization.
The Evangelistic Association uses the library in Charlotte, videos, literature, and, of course, the pulpit to spread its message. It had total revenue of more than $106 million in 2016. Franklin's duties don't end with the association his father started, though. He also oversees Samaritan's Purse, headquartered in Boone, North Carolina. The Evangelical Christian Humanitarian Organization operates in more than 100 countries. It had $635 million in revenue in 2016, making it the 22nd largest charity in the U.S., according to Forbes. And the younger Graham is leading these organizations at a time religious participation is dropping.
You got to raise the income for the organization. You're dealing with an organization that's built around the name of a person, and that person is not the focal point anymore. In a secular society where fewer people are going to church, fewer people are exposed to the Christian faith, and those that have been exposed to the Christian faith have been exposed in a negative way. So, yeah, those are all challenges, but I like a challenge.
For Franklin Graham, those challenges include expanding the Evangelistic Association his father started more than half a century ago, bringing his missionary relief organization to dozens of new countries, and, for the most part, staying clear of controversy. For Here and Now, I'm Jeff Tiberi in North Carolina.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.